For novelist Louise Erdrich, there always has to be a question at the beginning of the story.
This was really hard. This book was one of the hardest books I've ever written because I knew there had to be a question in the beginning of the book. But the book was about farming. And what was the story? What was the question going to be? How could I get the question to encompass enough people so that it would keep the reader engaged with it? I love to have that. And I kind of need that in a lot in books I read. I kind of need that suspense, that feeling that you're going to get an answer somewhere, somehow. This question, I was surprised by what it turned out to be.
We talk with Erdrich about farming, about writing, and about love. Her new novel is The Mighty Red. Then, as hurricanes batter the Carolinas, Georgia, and Florida, we find out what role climate change is playing in intensifying such storms. We replay our 2010 interview with climate scientist James Hansen about his book, Storms of My Grandchildren. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice, in-depth conversation with writers of all genres, on the air since 2004. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station, your favorite podcast app, or writersvoice.net. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Louise Erdrich has long been one of my favorite novelists, ever since I read her debut novel, Love Medicine. That was published in 1984. We've spoken with her on Writer's Voice previously about her novels, The Plague of Doves in 2008 and The Roundhouse in 2012. And I'm thrilled to welcome Louise Erdrich back to the show to talk about her just-released novel, The Mighty Red. In this conversation, Erdrich tells us about her writing process, about the farm crisis of 2008, and how that transformed farming, not for the better, in her native North Dakota, about Native American farming families who were devastated by the crisis, and how now those families are beginning to recover themselves and the land by using ancient practices that are more sustainable. But The Mighty Red is above all a story about love, the fraught love of two young men for the same woman, and the less complicated love between a mother and a daughter. Louise Erdrich, welcome back to Writer's Voice.
Thank you so much.
So this novel, The Mighty Red, the title refers to the Red River in the Red River area in North Dakota. Tell us something about the setting, the river, the land, and the community where the novel takes place.
All right. Let's start with the land. The Red River Valley is the youngest landmass on the continent. It's the very youngest, and it's incredibly flat. You know, I would bring people home from college, and they would be aghast at this, and they'd say, there's nothing here. But to me, everything was in the sky. Everything was there. And wherever I was, and still to this day, I can't see when the weather is coming. I'm used to that flatness. I love that flatness. I love that horizon. You stand in one place and there's horizon all around you. And it's impossible to kind of get that out of your system. You always want that. When I drive home now, home to North Dakota from Minneapolis, where I am, there is a place on I-94 around Sauk Center where it starts to flatten out and you can see this huge piece of sky, and my heart just lifts. So I love that. And it's also the home of a somewhat strange river, and that's the Red River. It's a river I grew up next to, and it just flowed all through my life, you know. And I finally got to write about how essential and important is and was. Where I grew up, it begins, the very beginning of the river, it flows north, which is highly unusual. So the land slants slightly to the north. And that also means that this river melts first at the source, right? So in the south, it's melted, and the river then travels. And as it goes north, there's nowhere to go because it's still frozen as it goes along. And so it floods. So we had floods constantly, and it wasn't, there was always sandbagging, there was always floods. And that is what made this land the most fertile land, one of the most fertile lands in the world.
Wow.
Yes, this topsoil that was laid down over about 9,000 years was so unbelievable. When people first started tilling and planting there, you could grow anything. You would throw a stick in the ground and it would grow. I mean, it was so incredible. But that has been diminished by continual use and abuse. And farmers love their land, but it's not always that farmers take care of their land. So we're seeing now this re-engineering of the river so that it does not flood, so it doesn't damage property, but it also does not lay down new sediment. So that's part of what I'm writing about.
Since we've started there, let's go a little bit deeper in there before we get into the actual story, because it's so compelling. I mean, the place is a character in this book in such a palpable way. And it's a character that is so much under threat, as you've just said. The characters in this book are very intimately involved in the land. Talk about some of the ways in which they have been forced to not be able to take care of the land in the way that their ancestors did.
Very interesting question with this view that there's like this juggernaut of chemical companies, fertilizer companies, herbicide and pesticide companies, and there's also a huge industrial farming ethos there now. In the book, it kind of goes into how in the 80s, during the Nixon administration, the Farm Home Administration, which was set up to get low interest loans to farmers, suddenly foreclosed on all of the loans. So there was this enormous crisis. People lost their homes, their lives, their livelihood, and sold to bigger farmers. So now there's just this huge, the farms are huge. And it's always kind of been that way. It's interesting because historically, in the very beginning with the farms, they were like 75,000 acres. They were called bonanza farms, and they were owned by out-of-state companies, and people would farm them. But they were, you know, people from North Dakota didn't really benefit so much from those giant farms as did the company. So, but they, after a certain point, all of those farms sold off into smaller holdings. So then we had a lot of smaller farmers coming through these times before the 1980s. And these smaller farms, again, this cycle has occurred where the bigger farms dominate and where sugar is very much an industrial crop. If you go up I-29 toward Canada, you will see huge factories. So those are sugar factories. And the great thing is that they keep the money now in North Dakota because they're actually not exporting their whole process. They're not exporting the raw beets. They're using their energy to keep more of the money in North Dakota. And that's great, but it's also a highly polluting and I would say in many cases toxic industry.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with acclaimed novelist Louise Erdrich about her newest work of fiction, The Mighty Red. You just spoke about the topsoil. There's a point in the book in which you say one of the characters is remembering, that's Winnie, we can get back to her, when her family owned the farm before it was forced to sell when the loans were called in so rapidly, you know, that the topsoil was at 1.60 feet deep. And you compellingly describe the dry and lifeless soil that has resulted from this, you know, basically poisoning of the soil of America and of North Dakota.
And I should qualify this here, because I think farmers know, I mean, people I've talked to know that they do their best to really take care of what they have. And this is set in 2008. And since then, the soil has become like, this is all we have. You know, we can't really make more, but we can conserve it. And these farming practices have changed quite a lot since 2008. I don't see those dust devils that I used to see a lot in the fields, because people are leaving stubble in the fields, are planting
amaranth.
No, nobody's planting amaranth. That was like in the future that could happen. But India plants amaranth. And no, we're still at the point where people are battling it out with Palmer amaranth. And, you know, it's really an interesting battle. I found this one of the most fascinating parts of the book to write about. I've been following herbicide resistance in weeds and just marveling at a plant that can evolve faster than chemicals can be invented to kill it. So it's evolved to the point, someone said, it's evolved to the point where it's just eating the poison. It's like, here's my food, where it's metabolizing whatever is thrown at it. You know, it's the deadliest kinds of herbicides that it has evolved a resistance to.
And this is amaranth or?
Palmer amaranth. But it's not quite the same as, there's so many versions of amaranth, and it's called some places water hemp. It's called canopodium. You know, there's all these different versions of it. So it can also manufacture itself in this incredible way. I had some in my yard. I don't know where it came from. And before I looked at it one day, and then it was 8 feet tall the next day. It's an incredible plant.
And is it nutritious the way other types of amaranth are?
Well, you can eat almost anything you can eat the leaves right out of your garden or wherever it lands. You know, these are weeds that are extremely nutritious and edible. But of course, it's not edible if it's poisoned.
Well, let's get back to the novel itself, though. It's really a wonderful book with really compelling characters. And let's just talk about a few of them. There's Crystal Freshette. She's a truck driver for a sugar beet company. Tell us about her and fold in talking a little bit about how 2008, because of course we're talking about the beginning of the financial crash of 2008, how that affected her.
Crystal. So everything started with Crystal, you know. She's so close to me in some ways. I really loved writing Crystal. Yeah, she's always been, well, she's unlike me in that she's extremely thrifty, and I sort of lose my bad habits are that I kind of just lose track of myself when I'm in, well, I can't go into that. Also, I'm sorry. I feel like I entered this conversation by being sort of awkward and not being able to think about what I've even written. That's because it's like the first time I've really talked about the book. And when there's something that happens when it goes from being all in you and then all on the page. And when you have this, when I have a relationship to the book that is so intimate, it's all inside of me, and it's still, even though it's on the page, I don't really see it. I'm not objective. I can hardly talk about a character. And then I'll say something like, oh, she's me. And then realize, no, she's thrifty and I'm a spendthrift. So that happens right in the beginning. And then soon I'll be able to see it from the outside in a different way. Well, we were talking about 2008, and in some ways, I feel as though 2008 got lost. History seems to have, maybe it's me, but history seems to be gobbling up space in our thoughts so quickly. There's so much information that we have to edit out so much that's happened. And I feel like what happened in 2008 was a tremendous and devastating collapse that happened to some people and then didn't happen to other people. People lost their entire savings. People lost their homes. People lost everything. And then some people didn't lose anything. And then we saw the banks get bailed out. And that hurt. I mean, it hurt me to think, okay, the banks are getting bailed out. Okay, I understand we need that. Something has to happen there. But we also need to, we need to support people who directly support people who lost their homes, who lost everything, you know? And so that's why I have a character who robs banks.
Yeah, and I have to say, a character you kind of cheer on.
I know, I really... But, and this is a part of it. This is a tribute to my father. My father was always interested in robbing banks. I mean, he didn't rob them himself, but he was interested in bank robberies. And he would tell me the latest. A lot of bank robberies occurred in the Dakotas. And some of the bank robbers were very strange or interesting people. And this didn't stop until, you know, I think surveillance and security became so, grew at such a pace that we don't see this anymore. But I would be reading the paper from home and see someone had dressed up like a penguin down to the feet and then tripped over the feet. And so I was caught, you know, just crazy things happened, crazy things.
Well, it's so interesting because, you know, this character and some of the other things you've just said, I really had no idea of the connections to your own life, of course, because we hadn't spoken. But it shines a light on how a novelist like yourself filters through their own experience to create characters that really have nothing to do with your experience, but are certainly informed by them.
Right.
So I want to go back to, well, we've talked about Crystal, but the novel is actually centered around her daughter, Kismet, who is also such a wonderful character. Tell us about Kismet and the two young men, Gary and Hugo, who compete for her love.
Oh, yes. Well, Kismet. I loved writing Kismet so much because she doesn't know who she's going to be. And so everything is really open to Kismet. And for no reason, really, she feels some intense pressure to get married. Like, there is no reason, but she does. And she is very malleable. So when she's pursued to the point of exhaustion, really, I think she gets married out of exhaustion. She does marry. And also she gets married to someone who she thinks will bail her out of this tremendous corner that her family has put themselves in. I mean, Crystal didn't do it. Her husband, Martin, did it. He runs off with a lot of money, too. He's just he's a bank robber.
A spendthrift.
He's a spendthrift. He's the one. I'm probably Martin. That's who I am. I'm the bank robber spendthrift who's stolen the church's renovation fund. And so she's in this. She's trying to get out of getting married to the son of a large-scale farmer. But once this happens, she feels she has to save her family in some way and do a normal thing. And there's a lot of pressure that's on young women who grow up in small towns like myself to do something that's normal and expected. And you can go a long time resisting it, but most of the time you fall back into one of these roles that you're expected to inhabit. And so she does. And that sets off. So it's a book about union, about it's divided into proposal, the vows, the wedding dinner. Wedding dinners are always so fraught with disaster. They can go wrong in an instant. And then marriage, and then after marriage. So it's about this world of love, trying to find love that's, I don't think even durable would be in her thoughts at the time. She just wants to find a place to land. It doesn't even have to be comfortable. You know, she just needs a place to land at that time. And it doesn't really occur to her that this is like a totally life-changing event that will really have repercussions for not only her, but her family, her community, the boy she's marrying, the boy she's not marrying. I mean, it sets off so many other parts of this story. And it doesn't occur to her really that she's done something that unknowingly really affects so many other people.
Another thing that I felt about this novel is that it really contrasts in a way two kinds of love. You know, on the one hand, there is the very complicated, you know, how she negotiates her way through that question that so many of us confront in relationships, and that is how much am I for myself and how much am I for the other?
Right.
And that's always a struggle. And of course, if you're a young woman like her, I mean, she's in her last year in high school when the story begins. That can take many decades to figure that one out. So that's
right.
One kind of love. But the other kind of love is the enduring love between her and her mother, which feels fairly uncomplicated. I mean, there are plenty of mother-daughter relationships that are very complicated, but this is not one of them. This is one of genuine support. And so I wonder if you could talk about those two different forms of love there in this novel.
I'm so glad you focused on the love between Crystal and Kismet. It's funny. It's full of understanding. It's full of exasperation. I mean, Crystal is trying to let her daughter know she does not have to do anything of the sort, right? Before this happened, before this disaster strikes the family, Crystal didn't need her daughter to fall into any kind of particular role. She just wanted to go to school, go to college. That's the only thing that she was asking of her. And I think Crystal understands her daughter pretty well and understands that she has really the good sense to realize that the only thing she can really do for her daughter is stay open to hearing her daughter's truth, whatever that is. Whatever it is, and being there somehow for her with whatever happens. You know, there isn't any other way. She's somehow realized, I don't know how, that she can't control her daughter. And that's one of the things I love about the relationship. There's no real sense that she has to control her. And there's no real sense that Kismet has to control her mom. They're just trying to survive. I mean, they've always been poor and they've never had a lot. They're not in extreme poverty. That's not true. They're always going to be okay as long as they can make enough money just to pay the bills. And they, at this point, have their house, but that becomes under threat. But they have that. And Crystal wants to really break that in a way. She doesn't really know why, but she just wants to break it and see if there's something else, you know, and she does it, but her mom doesn't go anywhere. Her mom just keeps supporting what she can. And really, I think the two of them have a relationship that is would really be based on, can I say, Crystal is the way she is because she had a very difficult mother and then very difficult grandmother. And so for some reason, she's just allowed this to be different.
That's wonderful. If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with novelist Louise Erdrich about her newest novel, The Mighty Red. I feel like the novel takes some real time to develop its characters, to get you into the interior emotional world of its characters. And in some ways, not a whole lot happens while that's going on. But the forces are gathering. And then the second half of the novel, so much does happen. Of course, we're not going to give away the things that we don't want to know. Spoilers here. But there is something that has happened that is referred to. We don't learn until later on exactly what it means. But it has colors everything
right
that goes on in this novel. And it particularly is a weight on Kismet's husband, on Gary. In many ways, it is what drives him to pursue her so intensively. He is hoping that she will free him of his demons. So, you know, without any spoilers, talk about how that foreshadowing works in this novel, how it colors everything that happens.
Well, I grew up around all of the people I wrote about here. I mean, they're not based on anybody in particular, but of course, there's a football team. We haven't mentioned there's a football team in the book. And for me, that was this cohesive unit of young men, these boys, young men, who've been playing football together since junior high. They were some people I had to write about as a group all of the time, except for Gary. Now, Gary is a quarterback, and the others, you know, people fall into roles that they play in sports because they're so intense in a small town. And so he's protected by other members of the team. He's protected. He's kind of made fun of. He's teased. And he's haunted. So he's haunted from the beginning. You see that and you understand that there's no reason given, but there's something happening to him. And so something happened to everybody else, to his best friend, particularly, but that is slowly gathering. You know, you're going to find this out in the book. You'll find out what happened. You'll find out why he's seeing a vision of someone on the team who is kind of horrifying, and why he's desperate to get these pictures out of his head. He has to come to terms with this. And he loves Kismet, and so he feels better with her. He doesn't have these pictures. He's diverted. And she brings him into her world. It's as though she has some magical quality. But I think it's just that he is comforted by her presence. And that's why he will not let her go. He is absolutely bent and determined on keeping her. But yes, there's something that brings you along. I mean, I have to always have to have this in a book. There has to be a question at the beginning of the book. This was really hard. This book was one of the hardest books I've ever written because I knew there had to be a question in the beginning of the book. But the book was about farming. And what was the story? What was the question going to be? How could I get the question to encompass enough people so that it would keep the reader engaged with it? I love to have that. And I kind of need that in a lot in books I read. I kind of need that suspense, that feeling that you're going to get an answer somewhere, somehow. This question, I was surprised by what it turned out to be. It's something that every small town contends with, something like this, something like what happened. And in a small community, it shapes and colors a community. So you see from the beginning that everybody's affected by it.
How did that question come to you?
I've always been aware of what happened. It's not what happened where I'm from, but it's happened to so many people. What happens is something that, again, it's young people not thinking it through, not thinking it through. And that's how it is to be young. You don't think it through, So Kismet doesn't, Gary doesn't, people don't think it through. The only person who always thinks it through is Gary's best friend. Eric always thinks it through, and he's an Eagle Scout. He's always prepared and becomes a medic, and he's got his family farms too. And he has a much more grounded view of life than anyone else, more than Kismet, more than Hugo, the other love interest.
Yes, exactly. The other lover. Yeah, and also that connects back to the farming, because he also sees what's happening to the land, and he sees that there is a way out. And I don't think the others do, at least not until the future.
Yeah, well, Winnie does. She knows that something has to be done. So because she's come from a family who lost their farm, and it was a farm that was, they were farming in a generally sustainable way. She sees it. Eric's family sees it. But they know, and I don't know if this is kind of buried in their conversations in the book or not, but they also understand that what they're doing with their farm is wonderful and it's beautiful, but they don't have it at a place where they can make a living off of it yet. That's the problem.
Yes, that is the problem, although that's changing as well.
I think it is too, but in 2008, you didn't have a real... I think it is too, but in 2008, you didn't have a real... There weren't very many models for alternative ways to farm and make a living. I mean, now you can do a lot of different things within a farm setting that can make money. But at the time, they're just figuring that out.
Well, it's a beautiful novel, The Mighty Red. And Louise Erdrich, I want to thank you so much for this really wonderful conversation about your process in writing it and the characters that people it.
Oh, thank you so much. I've enjoyed talking about it. And as I said, I haven't talked about it before. So this is just my most kind of vulnerable moment in trying to describe it. So thank you. Thank you for having me on, having the patience for it. And thank you. I want to thank your listeners also for being there. Thank you.
Louise Erdrich. The Mighty Red is a finalist for the Kirkus Prize for Fiction. Go to writersvoice.net for a link to an audio sample of the book. Next up, climate scientist James Hansen. Stay tuned after the break. That was Willie Nelson and Bob Dylan singing Heartland. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Go to writersvoice.net to find more great content, including web-only features like interview transcripts and extended interviews. As we produce this show, Hurricane Milton, one of the biggest storms in over 100 years, is bearing straight toward a vast swath of the state of Florida. This comes as that state, as well as North Carolina, is still reeling from the massive destruction of the last hurricane, just a few weeks ago, Hurricane Helene. In 2010, I interviewed the great climate scientist Dr. James Hansen about his book, Storms of My Grandchildren. Hansen predicted the intensification of storms like Milton and Helene. He told us that human-caused greenhouse gas pollution would increasingly load the dice of the climate system to produce the apocalyptic extreme weather events we're increasingly experiencing today. Let's listen back to an abridged version of that conversation. Dr. James Hansen is a hero of mine. A globally renowned climate scientist, Hansen was the first to alert the world to the threat of climate change when he testified before Congress in 1988. In 2010, Hansen came out with the book Storms of My Grandchildren. Coming up is an extended excerpt from our interview with him about the book. It's a good listen in light of next week's climate summit at the UN. Back in 2009, world leaders set a target limit for global temperatures to rise no more than 2 degrees centigrade. I asked James Hansen if he thought that target was adequate. But the really scary thought in light of his answer is that now we're on a path to rise 4 or 5 degrees centigrade. Here's Hansen's response to the question about 2 degrees centigrade, and you'll notice his prescience about the risk of coastal storms to New York City 2 years before Hurricane Sandy.
Well, we know that that's a disaster scenario. So far, we've had a rise in temperature of 8/10 of 1 degree Celsius, and we already see that the ice sheets on Greenland and Antarctica are not going to be stable on the long run. The rate at which Greenland is losing ice accelerated from 150 cubic kilometers several years ago to 300 cubic kilometers per year now, and likewise Antarctic rate of ice loss has accelerated. 2 degree warming would mean that those ice sheets are unstable and we will get sea level rise of several meters, which would have disastrous consequences. And we would also lose all the mountain glaciers around the world, which provide fresh water for actually billions of people from the rivers that originate in the mountains. And the expansion of the subtropics, which we can already see is affecting the southwest United States and causing the lakes to run dry and forest fires to increase, the Arctic sea ice would all be gone with the effects that would have on wildlife there and indigenous peoples. So we really, what we've learned in the last few years is that to stabilize climate at a level that the species that we now have on the planet to continue to exist is going to require that we stabilize carbon dioxide at a level of no more than 350 parts per million. And that would be possible if we phase out coal use over the next few decades and if we prohibit unconventional fossil fuels like tar sands.
One thing that seems striking to me is that there's an awful lot of talk about how climate change is going to affect those people over there, but there seems to be an assumption that it's not going to be affecting us here at home. What kind of sea level rise are we likely to see here in the U.S.?
That depends on what time scale we refer to, but that's why I'm concerned particularly about my children and grandchildren, because we can see very well what is going to happen as warming continues and as the ice sheets become more and more unstable. Because what happens is, as the rate of discharge of these icebergs to the ocean increases, we will reach a level at which they begin to cool the North Atlantic and the Southern Ocean around Antarctica. And as the low latitudes continue to get warmer, this increased temperature gradient from the low latitudes to the high latitudes will drive stronger frontal or cyclonic storms, which in extreme cases generate winds comparable to that in hurricanes. When you combine these stronger storms with the rising sea level, we're going to get disasters at coastal cities all along the United States coast and other coastlines, which because of the populations. I mean, we had a disaster at New Orleans, but that's a relatively small city. Once we start to have storms with storm tides and increasing sea level on large cities, we're going to have social and economic disasters associated with that, which will make New Orleans look like a small thing in comparison. You see, the thing is, it won't require a hurricane. Once you get a nor'easter with rising sea level and with increasing strength in these mid-latitude frontal storms, then you can get a comparable response without an actual hurricane.
Well, you talk about the loading the dice as a metaphor. What is the relationship between that and the frequency of these storms?
Well, I used the dice to illustrate the fact that although natural fluctuations are as yet still larger than the mean rise in temperature, but the perceptive person can notice that the frequency of unusually warm seasons is already beginning to increase. The dice are loaded. The same applies to extremes of the hydrologic cycle. By that I mean on the one extreme, heavy rainfalls and floods, and on the other extreme, heat waves and droughts. Because as the world gets warmer, the atmosphere can hold more water vapor. That means that when you do have rainfall, you can get heavier rainfall and bigger floods. But at the times and places when it's dry, because of the increased temperature, you get greater drying and higher temperatures. And we can see that the dice are already beginning to be loaded. For example, where I live, we've had two so-called 100-year floods in the last 15 years. And that's the kind of loading of the dice that is going to occur as we continue to push the climate to the more extreme global warming.
You give really what you say is a short course in climatology. We don't have time to go into the kind of detail that you did in the book, which is fascinating. But can you give us some of the highlights of that so that we can understand what are some of the issues here and be able to be more intelligent when people who deny that there's climate change come back with their arguments?
The fundamental thing about climate is the inertia of the system, which is easy to understand because the ocean is 4 kilometers, about 2.5 miles deep. The ice sheets are a couple of miles thick. These things do not change immediately as you begin to apply a forcing to them. And by a forcing, I mean something that alters the planet's energy balance. So, for example, if we add carbon dioxide to the atmosphere, that reduces the heat radiation that the planet is emitting to space because it's like a blanket on the Earth. So it keeps the heat more effectively at the Earth's surface. And that radiation imbalance then causes the ocean to begin to get warmer. As the ocean gets warmer, it melts the ice shelves, which are the tongues of ice that come out from the Antarctic and Greenland ice sheet into the ocean. As the ice sheets begin to melt, that allows the ice streams, the more plastic part of the ice sheets, to begin to discharge their icebergs to the ocean more rapidly. And so this all takes time because, you know, just as your swimming pool doesn't warm up immediately when the sun comes up, it takes a time to absorb the energy and get warmer. But we see this happening. We see the deep ocean getting warmer. We see the ice streams beginning to move faster. They're discharging icebergs more than twice as fast as they were just 10 years ago. So that's why the problem is an intergenerational issue. We are the ones adding the gases to the atmosphere that cause these processes to get started, but it's our children and grandchildren who will bear the brunt of the problem. And that's why it's an issue of intergenerational inequity. It's one that we didn't understand when our parents were beginning this fossil, the heavy fossil fuel use. They didn't realize that they were going to cause problems for future generations. But now the picture has become clear. We realize that we are causing problems for our children and grandchildren if we don't get on a different path. And that's why we have to begin to address it now. The truth is, the things that we need to do make sense for other reasons. Why should we continue to go after the last drops of oil on the earth and exploit these really dirty, unconventional fossil fuels when they wouldn't last indefinitely anyhow? We're going to need to move on to cleaner energies. So why not do it now and preserve a planet and allow the other species to continue to exist, rather than trying to get the last drop of these fossil fuels?
You're listening to Writer's Voice, and we're talking with climate scientist Dr. James Hansen. His book is Storms of My Grandchildren. When you say that this takes a long time to unfold, you also point in the book that it's taking an awful lot shorter time than other climate change events in the Earth's history. Because, of course, a lot of the climate deniers say, well, Earth has warmed up before, and it's been just peachy. So explain about these timelines that you say in the book, we're doing this about 10,000 times more powerful. The human changes are 10,000 times more powerful than natural climate forcings. So if this is a long time, how come it's so short?
Yeah. Well, it's certainly true. There have been huge climate changes in the Earth's history. If we go back 50 million years, there was no ice on the planet. It was much warmer. Sea level was 75 meters, about almost 250 feet higher than it is now. And, of course, that if you got to that situation, it would be pretty stable. But to get there from here would, of course, flood billions of people out of their homes. And we have lived in a climate, the Holocene, the last 10,000 years, in which the climate has been relatively stable with sea level at the level it is now. And, yeah, the rate at which we are changing carbon dioxide is about 10,000 times faster than the natural rates of increase or decrease that gave rise to these very large but slow changes of the climate during the Earth's history. And civilization developed with the climate that we've had during the last 10,000 years. And unless we want enormous disruptions to civilization, we need to keep the climate roughly within that range that has existed during the last 10,000 years.
Hansen says that we do have some time to turn things around, but to do that, we'll have to get off coal and fast. You say we need to keep all the coal in the ground, and
yeah,
we need a transition period to get rid, you know, to stop using oil and gas.
Yeah, well, the reason is, first of all, there's more coal. There's more carbon in coal than there is in oil and gas. And the oil and gas are very convenient fuels, which are limited in amount. We've used about half of the oil that we know about. And it's very difficult to see how we could prevent the use of the readily available oil and gas. It's owned by countries like Russia and Saudi Arabia. But coal not only has the most carbon dioxide, but it's also the dirtiest fuel. It's the one that we could decide to leave in the ground. So it's clear, unless you're going to tell, you know, I met with the environment minister of Germany after I'd written a letter to the chancellor, and they agreed that we would have to limit the CO2 emissions and try to get CO2 back below 350 parts per million. But at the same time, they're planning to build more coal plants. And my question then was, well, then how are you going to convince Russia to leave its oil in the ground, its gas in the ground, and how to convince Saudi Arabia to leave its oil in the ground? And, of course, there is no prospect for doing that. So the only practical way to keep CO2 at a level that allows our climate to stay close to what it is now is to phase out coal use. So it simply doesn't make sense to continue to rely on that. Since it's a finite resource anyway, we need to move on to the era beyond fossil fuels.
My final questions have to do with the politics. You were the guy who actually explained climate change to Al Gore. But you write that the Clinton-Gore administration, you say that they were ineffectual in this matter, and you're being polite, that emissions substantially increased. What do you think happened? I mean, Gore understood this. Obama seems to also understand. And yet the talk is greater than the action here. Why?
Well, I think it's largely because of the fact that in Washington, as well as other capitals around the world, money talks, and the fossil fuel industry's got a lot of money. I'm encouraged by the fact that Al Gore, in the Copenhagen discussions, he did clearly state, I believe for the first time, made a clear statement in public that it made more sense to put a price on carbon emissions. And to use that money to return it to the public one way or another, either as a payroll tax deduction or as a dividend, as I suggest. The reason I prefer a dividend is we can then very easily see that it equals the amount that was taken in from the fee on carbon. And also half the people are not on payrolls. They're either retired or they're involuntarily out of work. But in any case, he made this clear statement, and also John Kerry made a statement that indicated he was open-minded about that, that didn't necessarily have to be a cap-and-trade with offsets scheme. So the politics is difficult because in our democracies, it's no longer strictly a case of one person, one vote. In many cases, it's $1. One vote.
Right.
Unless we can get campaign finance reform so that we can get money out of politics, it is going to be difficult.
You're hearing an interview I originally aired with climatologist James Hansen in February of 2010 about his book, Storms of My Grandchildren. What do you think about the EPA regulating carbon dioxide? Do you think that that's an end run around the politics? Do you think that's going to work?
Well, it obviously is an end run, and on the short term, it can work and get us moving in the right direction, but it's not the best approach on the long run, because if we get an election and a different administration comes in, they may direct EPA in a different way. So we really need to make the fundamental changes, and as I keep repeating, but the only way to do that is to make the price of fossil fuels gradually rise so that the competition, the clean energies and the energy efficiency can compete and take over for the fossil fuels, and we move on to a cleaner future for our children and grandchildren.
What would you say now to listeners? You know, I mean, this is the point at which I guess listeners get told that they should call their congressperson, but given that Congress, as you say, you know, is listening more to the dollar votes than the ballot votes, what do you think citizens should do?
Well, I think that next spring is the key time, because now there is this reassessment of what the international response is going to be, because nothing was decided in Copenhagen. But it was actually useful that China and the U.S. did talk together and even signed the final, agreed on this final accord, which doesn't have any clear actions in it. But it is going to depend now. The United States is going to have to decide where it is going. And I think if we can have an honest, open discussion about cap and trade with offsets versus an honest price with the funds distributed to the public, I think the public will be able to understand that if we're going to get off fossil fuels, we've got to put a rising price on that. And if the funds that are generated are distributed to the public, they'll go along with that. This is actually a trial of this has occurred in British Columbia, which is working very well. So we need to try it in the United States, I think.
Is this kind of the equal and opposite thing that happens in Alaska, where everybody gets a fossil fuel dividend?
Well, yeah, that dividend came from selling oil. But the dividend I'm talking about would come from taxing the oil and gas and coal at the mine, and that money then being distributed to the public.
So we need to come up with some kind of slogan that can say that well.
Well, the slogan I suggested was 100% dividend or fight. Because Congress, what they want to do, whenever there's a money source, they like to give it to their favorites or to invest it. They like to make decisions about investments like clean coal. That's the marketplace should make the decisions as to what technologies are going to win. If you put a rising price on carbon, then all the competitors will try to give you a lower price. And put the money in the hands of the public and let them invest it where they think is most effective rather than where Congress wants to put it.
Well, Jim Hansen, Storms of My Grandchildren, The Truth About the Coming Climate Catastrophe and Our Last Chance to Save Humanity. That's the book. Thanks so much for talking with us here on Writer's Voice. There is nothing more important, I think, for us to think about, talk about, and act about.
Well, thanks very much for having me on.
Dr. James Hansen is the head of NASA's Goddard Institute for Space Studies. That was my interview with Jim Hansen in 2010. Next week, we talk with acclaimed novelist Robert Harris about his fascinating novel set in England on the brink of World War I, Precipice. Also, historian and podcaster Giles Milton tells us about his new book, The Stalin Affair, The Impossible Alliance That Won the War. That's World War II. Don't miss it. And if you've missed any part of this episode or just want to listen again, subscribe to the Writer's Voice podcast with your favorite podcast app. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. Stay connected with Writer's Voice. Find us on YouTube, Facebook, X, and Instagram. Just search on Writer's Voice. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.